You know, I thought about at the end of last week's shiur, Yitzchak asked me to complete the story with the Rav, with Rabbi Savitsky, and I was hesitant. And then it dawned upon me that this recording is for the year 2050, so if I don't complete the story, people may not know to research it. So I just want to begin the start of the shiur by picking up the story. But let me very briefly review what we spoke about last week. We spoke about the fact that the Rav came to America. Give me a little bit more output, a little louder, because I'm very schwach today. It's a fast day, and, you know, following the news in Israel, it's not exactly an easy period here with Rav Ovadia, with, you know, everything he says is right, but the way he says it, it's unbelievable. And I said after Rabin's assassination, I said a vote, I don't know if Amity appreciated it, but I said, it's on tape, if you go back to the tapes, the assassination. I said, look, it's, you know, you have people you're angry at. That's why Chazal were attacking, La Moshina Malti Tikva. Take out all your frustrations in that prayer. And let God do the rest. You understand? If you got, you're made at this point, La Moshina Tikva, Risha, whatever it is. And then let God decide what to do further. But we can't, God forbid, if we take things on our own hands. But, you know, there's a way to speak, and you have to know also with an audience. You understand? I learned early in life that if I say something slightly off the wall, my students will take it 100 times further. You understand that the Rebbe says something, so either if I'm too mekiel, it's no good. If I'm too machme, it's no good. I learned that as a Rebbe already in the 1960s. So I was always careful, you know, in my public image, never to be too machmir, never to be too mekiel, to be a decent individual. The Rambam Shita, Shvil Hazav. I myself have very extreme opinions. I mean, as far as relationship with Reform and Conservative, I'm so much more to the right than my Rebbe was, than the Rev was. It's light years, we're light years apart. But nevertheless, in public, you have to tone it down a little, because if people hear you talk, they'll go and take swords. So it's an exciting time, but it's an exhausting time. And I said, one of my good friends called me last night, and we both had said the same thing. You don't know what you wake up to in the state of Israel. I figured yesterday morning I'm going to hear the news. At 6 o'clock I switched the news on. 6 a.m. I figured the Pope is coming, investigations, who knows what. The whole news, the whole day, the whole night. Everything was Rav Ovadia, and how they, you know, today everything, this is only tape recorded, but there it's videoed. You mamish can't deny what you said because it's on video. But be it as it may, coming back to the theme of today, which is important, the Rav came to America to be a Rosh Yeshiva. Had he gone to Chicago, and you think about what could have been, it's overwhelming. But it didn't work out that way, and it was the Depression. And the Rav gets involved with the rabbinate. He goes to Boston, and Hakol Tolui B'Mazel. Boston was in the midst of big machloket, kashrut, Rabbi Krieger died, the Rav comes in, and Reb Lazer Silva, the whole relationship, the Agudas HaRabbanim, his dreams, his wishes, his goals, his ideals. It was a Rav, had he succeeded, we would have never known the Rav, that's for sure. Now, what happens in Boston and what totally leaves tremendous scars on him is, of course, the Kashrus controversy. I have all the details in the book. I don't want to repeat it. As far as I know, not as far as I know, but I can simply state as a fact, no one has published more details on that controversy than I have. I researched as much as possible. I don't say I did it thoroughly. I didn't go into the archives in Boston. This is when someone will do a definitive doctorate on the Rav. They'll have to see if there's anything available in archives. I can tell you this. A lot of, and I didn't say this last week, and I want to say something just to share a personal note, and I'll tell you who the players were so you can appreciate what I'm talking about. That there were lots of stories about the Rav and the tremendous machloket and the kashrut. And I remember when I was a kid, there was a rumor that the Rav sat in jail, that he was indicted and he was in jail, he went out in bail. There were all, you know, stories. Once there's a kernel of truth, so the stories multiply. While I was researching this, no less a person than Rabbi Menachem Genach. And you have to know who Rabbi Menachem Genach is. I'll come to that later. If not today, next week. What his relationship with the Rav, because there's a very unique relationship there, and I'll explain to you why, but it's not, I can't yet do it because it doesn't fit in historically. But certainly Rabbi Menachem Genach is one of the most reliable people who knows the Rav. Rabbi Genach was positive that one night the Rav spent in jail. And in the OU office, he got me to call Yitzchak Twersky, Zeichen Tzadik Livracha. And, you know, I felt so awkward. I know Yitzchak going back many decades, but to call and ask him, but Menachem had me so wound up, he said, Rav Aaron, you can't be certain your scholarship is correct unless you make this call. So when he told me, you know, my scholarship not correct unless I make the call, I called Rav Yitzchak in Boston, and I say, look, you have to forgive me for asking you this question, but I'm sitting here with Menachem Genach, and Menachem is ready to swear that the Rav spent a night in jail when the Kashrus investigation got underway. So Yitzchak told me, you can tell Menachem it's absolutely not true. The Rav never spent a night in jail. And he said what happened was, and then I later got this from my research, that the Attorney General, in other words, there was pressure on the Attorney General to indict the Rav. I mean, think what we're talking about. Pressure on the Attorney General of the state of Massachusetts, Bushnell, to indict the Rav. No, he didn't know what to do, so he was very smart. He got a retired judge who was Jewish to investigate and to report back to him. And on the basis of what that judge will tell him, he'll then take it further. And that's the way the investigation begins. Now, what I said last week about Rabbi Savitsky and the Rotten connection, as a kid, we always heard that Rabbi Savitsky was a bat plukta with the Rav from this period. We never knew about the Rotten connection. When Joey Abelow told me about the Rotten connection, then it all fits into place. Because, you see, these people were struggling. It was a terrible America. The Rabbanim had limited ability to earn panasa. It's not like today where Talmidei Chachamim can become Rashi Yeshiva. There weren't those many yeshivas. There weren't those many yeshiva students. I remember yeshiva and yeshiva college. I once researched how many students were there in yeshiva and yeshiva college. Let's take 1940. You're dealing with a few hundred. The whole high school and the whole college and the smicha program. And you add it all together, you're dealing with a few hundred. So you can understand what we're talking about. So panasa's panasa. And they felt because Abelau, who headed up the local Vod, headed up the Chevra Shas, the Vod Ha'ir, was a Ratna, it was coming to Rabbi Savitsky. And the Machloket was terrible. It was a lot more than Savitsky involved. The owners of the slaughterhouses were not happy with the Rav because of the standards he required, because of the unionization of the Shochtim. And of course, the machloket, once the machloket begins and you accuse people of money, I don't have to tell you Lashon Hara, Rechilit, what goes on. So it became a cause celebre. What Rabbi Reuben wanted me to mention, and this too could be the documents that survive, but this I know to be an absolute fact, not that I ever researched it, but I remember Bisha'at Ma'aseh, people were talking about it, and anyone from Boston from the era, it must be the 50s into the 60s, anyone from that era knows the story. And the story is very simple. At a much later date, Rabbi Savitsky had problems with the American tax authorities. I don't know what the problems were exactly, but there was a problem of tax evasion. Now, one thing about the IRS, when they latch onto you, they are unremitting. And I'll say this in parentheses. The IRS works with a very, I understand it, it's very simple. In America, there are over a quarter of a billion citizens. Hundreds of millions have to pay taxes. So you can't catch every tax evader. But when they catch someone, they don't let them go. Because that one they're catching, they got to squeeze him to make up for the other nine that they're not catching. So IRS is IRS, and there was a tremendous problem with Rabbi Savitsky. And I don't know details, but it reached the point where there was mamash achshash that they would not settle for a fine, but actually want to put him into jail. And the Rav used all his influence, which was then plentiful, because he was the Rav. He was not just some young hotshot rabbi who was totally out of place in Boston, but he was the Rav. And he was able to work out that Rabbi Savitsky paid a penalty, and there was nothing further than that. Now, many of the Rav's Balabatim said to him, Rebbe, what are you killing yourself for? Don't you remember what happened years ago? And the Rav's answer was straight and to the point, that to save a Jew from going to jail, you have to turn over heaven and earth. And this was quoted to me many, many years ago. So that's what Yitz wanted me to add. And I thought afterwards, why shouldn't I add it to the Rav's covered? With Rabbi Savitsky, I'm not detracting from his covered. It has to be researched what happened, and it's probably in the local Boston Jewish Advocate. You probably will find reference to it. But it speaks to the Rav's covered that he was a person with whom he had such a tremendous machloket, and it involved such great heartache. And many years later, this was the Rav. And by the way, this was part of the Rav's personality. The story I told you with, I don't know if I told the story here, but with the Naturic, right? Didn't I tell the story here with Rav Scheinberger, with the $500 check for the Eid HaRei did? It's exactly the same story. And they went crazy with the Rav. What are you giving the money for? But the Rav didn't view things in a narrow fashion. In other words, the person has a point of view, but one has to be generous beyond that. Okay. Now, I want to come in to what, and here I have to tell you, I had a lot of nachat once in life. I gave a public lecture in the United States, and I spoke about the Rav in Boston. And I said, it's my feeling, after all my research, that what the Rav would probably consider the greatest, Yitz, you missed it all. I did everything with Savitsky, the works, nothing left out, and you're saying slich, it's like it's Yom Kippur today. What can one do? I walked in this morning, I had to pinch myself. I heard the boys davening. I don't know whether it's Tainus Esther or whether it's Yom Kippur today. You should have heard the davening here. It's unbelievable. Where I come from, a Tainus Esther, the slichus is swallowed, if you understand what I'm saying. But Baruch Hashem, here we're still in a yeshiva and we don't work, so it's a good slichus. Anyway, I made the point that in my humble opinion, the Rav's greatest achievement was Maimonides. A man got up, an old man who had studied with the Rav in Moriah for many decades, and he said in front of hundreds of people, Rabbi Rakefet, you don't know how right you are. And he said, I was sitting in Moriah when the Rav once said, Eibichvel gein segan Eden, if I'll go to heaven, it's only because of Maimonides. And I want to devote the first part of today's shiur to Maimonides. Now, you fellas are sitting here, can I inherit, there's a big crowd in the room, and you're sitting here wondering, what's the big deal, Maimonides? We have hundreds of day schools in America, tens of thousands of day school students, we have day schools of this nature and that nature, separate and mixed and under one roof and separate classes and totally integrated mixed classes and day schools that stress Gemara and day schools where Gemara is just another subject and you can pay your nickel and take your choice and you're wondering what is Maimonides? Yes, your problem is you're sitting in the year 2001. Go back to the 1930s. A day school made the vanished American buffalo look popular. Where did you have day schools? Think for a minute. Where did you have day schools? New York City, the heart of Yiddishkeit, you had a handful of day schools. Outside of New York City, the only day school you had was in Baltimore. And Baltimore was a near the aim of Israel. Whatever the reasons are, Baltimore has always had a very powerful, dynamic Torah community. Some people say, and again, it's a theory, I don't know whether it's right or wrong, I cannot say I researched the era, but it's due to Rabbi Avraham Rice. It seems the first Talmud Chacham who had a real top grade smicha and knew how to learn and to be a posek settled in Baltimore. I believe it was in the 1840s. And they say as a result of Rabbi Avraham Rice settling in Baltimore, that's why Baltimore became a dynamic Torah community until this very moment. Rabbi Harold Schaffman, who relates, it may be a brother, of the Rabbi Shaftman I spoke with on Thursday night, Rabbi Solomon Shaftman, the former president of the Rabbinical Council, the rabbi of Israel of Flatbush for so many decades. Rabbi Harold Shaftman did a doctorate at Bernard Revel, and he published the volume later. It's a massive volume. It needs editing, but it's a volume filled with so much information on Rabbi Reis and his era. But that may be. So now in Baltimore, in my mind, in Boston, it's 1937. Now, why did the Rebbe organize Maimonides? Why is 37 the crucial year? And here, too, you have to come off the mountain and come down to basic facts of life. Almost every day school organized in America was organized as a result of the fact that the Talmud Chacham involved had children who were growing up. You take Yeshiva College. Yeshiva College was organized because Rabbi Revel had two sons, Norman and Hirschel, and he needed a place to send them. And he was dreaming, and that was the catalyst that got him started. Yeshiva's Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan, which we are sitting in at this very moment, let's be market toiva, was organized because Rabbi Matlin had a son, Akiva, who had graduated Eitz Chaim and was going to Seward Park High School on the Lower East Side of New York, and he needed a place to learn Gemara, so Rabbi Matlin got a few kids together and said, I'm going to teach you Gemara when you finish high school, and that's how Yeshiva Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan gets off the floor in 1897. Ramaz was organized because Rabbi Luchstein had a son, Haskell Luchstein, who needed a school to go to. The Rav had two daughters and a son. By 1937, Atara was born in Berlin. Tova was born in Boston. His wife is expecting number three, who turns out to be Chaim. And he needs a place to educate them. And that's why Maimonides becomes a necessity with all the other factors involved. But it's an amazing thought. The fact that we have to teach our children becomes a tremendous impetus and catalyst in creating day schools that later changed the course of Torah history in America. Now, the Rav had to be very brave. Do you know why the Rav had to be very brave? Read Bernard Revel. See the opposition that Bernard Revel had when he organized Yeshiva College, when he organized Talmudical Academy High School. Read Shulamit Meiselman's memoir, The Soloveitchik Heritage. Read the Rav, the two volumes that just appeared that were cited so beautifully for a change in Hatzofer on Friday. Read. See the opposition the Rav had. Orthodox Jews maledicted the idea. This is ghettoization. We came to America to come out of the ghetto. If we wanted to remain in the ghetto, Avram Yaakov, we could have remained in the ghetto in Chaslovich. We could have remained in the ghetto in Pruzhana. We could have remained in the ghetto in Warsaw. You come to the great United States. Education is free. Particularly, you come to a city like Boston. The heart of New England. The finest schools. The finest teachers in the shadow of Harvard, Radcliffe, MIT, the finest hospitals. And you're going to take your Jewish children and isolate them? You are a backward, outlandish, outmodish fanatic. And that's the way many Orthodox Jews related to the Rav. Alach et kama v'kama, the non-observant Jews. Enmity, hatred. You're creating anti-Semitism, separatism. You don't start to understand what the Rav went through in 1937 in organizing Maimonides. It required courage, which is beyond our comprehension today. A day school, Boston, Massachusetts, 37? Are you insane? A burden on the community? A plague on the children? What will happen to them? How will they turn out? And this required unbelievable guts. Okay, that's number one. Number two, I want to deal with the problem. People have called me on this problem. It seems, what's the name of the Rav from Ateret Kohanim, the Frenchman? And Rav Avinir recently wrote about this, and he said they should check with students of Rav Soloveitchik. So lo and behold, I got at least 3 or 4 calls on the issue. Anyone who raises the question about co-education in Maimonides, the question is a non-starter. 1937, I heard the Rav say this himself, but I don't have to quote the Rav, I just have to do a little research. It's either co-educational or nothing. The Balabatim is so totally opposed to yeshiva education, separatism. In order for the Rav to organize Maimonides, he has to plead, cajole. 1937, you're going to talk about separate schools? Well, you begin with what? I have in my book what they begin with. I don't forget what I wrote, but 5, 6, 7 children. Separate schools. We might as well talk right now that this afternoon we're going to China to dance a Hora and Mao Zedong's tomb. That's how realistic separate schools were for Boston in 37. It's an absolute idiocy to discuss it that the Rav had a choice. He chose mixed education. He's in favor of mixed education. It's an absolute idiocy and shows a total lack of historic understanding and insensitivity to what 1937 was all about. Now, I can bring you another proof, but it doesn't require proofs. When Hailai was organized, you know, you live, Lawrence lives in Lawrence today. Today, Lawrence, friend was telling me, people I know died in their 90s, their home was sold. These people were modern Orthodox people from Crown Heights originally to Lawrence. Modern Orthodox people, their children all went to Yeshiva University. Believe me, in their family, it's totally modern Orthodox. And their home was sold, and someone described to me, a friend of mine, walked by their home Friday night, a few weeks after it sold. He heard singing. He peeked in. 20 men with bekishes, with strimals. It was a Hasidic Friday night. Women were nowhere to be seen except they were serving the men. And he said, "Oy vey, what happened to my friend's home? Take a look." That is Lawrence today. You don't realize what Far Rockaway was. Rabbi Emanuel Rachman versus Rabbi Ralph Pelkowitz. It's an amazing thing. Today, the white shul is considered the liberal shul. Shari Tfiller is the one with the 7-foot mechitza. In those days, Rabbi Rachman was so-called left-wing orthodoxy. Rabbi Pelkowitz was right-wing orthodoxy, if I can apply that term to him, which I doubt that it's correct. And there was a handful, a nucleus of firm Jews, Baruch Hashem. Now, when Hailai is forming a high school, it's probably the late 50s, as I recall. They came to see the Rav. And one of the big problems was, should the classes be mixed or separate? And the Balabatim, some said, no, it's not good, we have to have separate. And some said, no, Rav Soloveitchik has a viewpoint, he has mixed classes. A committee came to see the Rav. Now, I was not there. I cannot tell you. Then, don't misunderstand me. I was a kid. I was a sheikitz. I was younger than you. Imagine I would have said to Rebbe, I'd like to sit with you and you talk with these balabatim. They would have thrown me out head first. Today, I'm in a different ballpark. But let's look what I was then. So I wasn't there. But the word went out. The people that spoke with the Rav came out and told us. We were curious kids. And I'm an eyewitness to what was said. I believe Rav Heschel quotes, Heschel Schechter quotes it as well. But we were eyewitnesses. They came out and they told us, the Rav said very simple, don't look at what I did. I had no choice. If you can have separate classes, adarabba, you can do it because today the world is different. But in 1937, and the Rav said very bluntly what I quoted before, my choice was either the way I organized it or there would have been no day school at all. And that's very crucially important. Now, I can tell you, when I learned in Lakewood, so there was always, Danny, to answer your question, 10 to 12, but by the clock, that's when I'm home on Purim. 10 to 12, because I have to daven early mincha, I have to go to sleep, and then I have to take off. I have to... you know, the girls yesterday sent me, they called off the second class and they gave me a clue and I had to drive over to the La Rome where there were 10 beautiful women waiting for me. I tell you, I never saw, they took pictures, the men there in the lobby were going crazy. Who's this guy surrounded by all these Miss Americas, you know, they were going crazy. Then from there I had to go to the second clue to the great synagogue to another 10 women waiting for me. A rabbi walked by, Rabbi James Gordon, his teeth fell out. He couldn't believe what was going on. And the Rebbe surrounded by 10 beauties again, a picture. Then I had to go to, thank God, the final stop was on the mall in Ben Yehuda. One of the girls was a mime and one was juggling and I had to take a picture with them. So they're rewarding me today. I'm supposed to get the Mashalach Manis from them. I told Lorraine, call and see if it's waiting. I don't want to go there in vain. But they overdid it. I never was so tired in my life. They don't realize my age. If I'm, I said one shear to go three different places, it should have ended at the Great Synagogue. So I have to pace myself on Purim, particularly because I'm leaving the country next week and I have a tremendous schedule in Chutz Laaretz. So God gives strength. Now back here. When I learned in Lakewood, they always criticized the Rav. Lakewood, in my days, I don't know how Lakewood is today, maybe Ezra can tell me because he has a brother who learned in Lakewood, but when I learned in Lakewood, they wasted half their time being critical. I know why they had to do it, because in order to go to Lakewood, you had to be willing to make that big sacrifice to give up college, give up a profession, to have this tremendous bitachon that God will pay you a salary every month. So in order to get you to feel the need, they had to criticize everyone else. So they were constantly criticizing the Rav. Okay. One of their big criticisms of the Rav was the fact that Maimonides was mixed. So in Lakewood, they told me a cute story. They said, you want to see the difference between Reb Aaron to the Rav? Reb Aaron Cutler we're talking about now. Told me the following story. In Lakewood, there's a day school. I think it's called Bezalel. I think that was the name of it. If anyone's from Lakewood, they can correct me. So it was a day school for boys and for girls. Of course, nowadays it's not good enough, and the Lakewood crowd has a cheder. That's a new concept that didn't exist in the 60s, but exists today. So they tell the story when they're ready to build the day school, they came to Reb Aaron Cutler, and they told Reb Aaron, Rebbe, we simply have a tremendous problem, a financial problem. We'd like your permission to build a day school that, at least for the first six grades, will be mixed. So Reb Aaron Cutler said to them, Zagmir, tell me, do you have enough money to build a yeshiva to build the school for boys and girls together? They said, no, we have to raise it, it's going to be very difficult. Just as you don't have enough money to build one school, you won't have enough money to build two schools. But just as you raise for one school, you'll raise for two schools. And Reb Aaron Paskin, Chas v'Chalila, they should have mixed classes. And as I recall, the Bezalel school had separate classes for men, separate classes for women. However, this was in 1950. It wasn't in 1937. It was a different America. So now, once, so people will say to me, why hasn't Maimonides changed over the years? Look, a school, an institution, takes on its own inertia. Labriot. I personally believe that it's impossible for a school to shift gears. It's the way a school runs. Their vested interests, their teachers, their faculty, their tradition, their students. Once Maimonides began that way, and you're rolling into the 50s and into the 60s, it's not easy for an institution to change. Particularly in Boston, at least at that point, it was more isolated. It's not New York City, where everyone breathes down everyone else's back. Boston was Boston. Over the years, there were two other day schools. I don't know whether all three are functioning today. I think only two out of the three are functioning. There was competition for Maimonides. Maimonides today, once again, is being attacked on the right and on the left. These are problems that go on in a community. Nevertheless, Maimonides, until this moment, has retained its tradition of mixed classes. You want my personal opinion? I do not think that mixed classes are viable in the 21st century. I think ultimately the dynamic independence of the Torah world, with all its problems, I don't want to overstate the case that we're on top of the world and be so triumphant. We have tremendous problems. Our world, the Haredi world, if you know what went on here just this past week, you can get sick. You read in the papers, you heard in the news, a yeshiva boy driving without a license was killed he crashed up his car on the road from here to Yam HaMelech. The real story came out this weekend. It was a Gera Hasid who was thrown out of one of the Gera Yeshiva. He and two other Gera Hasidim drove down to Yericho to gamble in the Las Vegas den of iniquity there, which is just unbelievable how smart the Palestinians are. The Palestinians today are smarter than the Jews. Someone said about them, you're just advising them. No wonder they're smarter than the Jews. But that may be, I don't know. But they're smarter than the Jews today. They're taking billions of dollars out of our pockets, the gambling, and in the gambling, plenty of Haredi Jews are going there to gamble. These are Gera Hasidim. I said, this is the Haredi world. It's the old problem. There's only one role model. If you don't shape up, you ship out. That's the worst possible chinuch. It goes against everything. Keneged Abab Banim Divrat Torah. On April 2nd in Los Angeles, in Beverly Hills, I'm giving a talk on what it means. Keneged Abab Banim Divrat Torah. I hope in our world we have room for everyone. That's tzaddikim, there. Some people by nature are a shayim. You can't help it. You're a baal olam hazeh. You eat without a mus. You drink without a mus. You gamble without a mus. You run around. We got to take that guy and tame him for Torah too. That's the challenge to a rebbe. Just to teach chachamim. Just to teach gifted, wonderful young people who are filled with Torah and Yirat Shemayim, and just to turn them on, what's the great achievement? And don't laugh at me. Ari is already laughing. He says, the Rebbe's sitting there in the kollel, look at wonderful tzaddikim, but you forget, I put 20 years in BMT, and I'm not exactly ashamed of the results. 20 years with tzaddikim, with rishayim, with tamim, with sheni yodei lishal. I put in, God, 20 years, 18 years in Machon Gol. Don't minimize the results. 16 years in Machal. Now Baruch Hashem, my 13th year in Midrashik Noria since the day it opened. So don't think I only sit in the kollel with tzaddikim. And also, you guys are not such great tzaddikim. I peeked in yesterday to see whether you put me on at 6:31. I opened that door. I saw in this room Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein and two students. Ezra, am I telling the truth? Ezra, yes or no? The Rebbe's telling the truth? You forget about your friends. The Rebbe's your friend. They're your friend. I'm your friend. How many came? Let me hear. And now they talk Lashon Hara on the Rebbe, on Taina Testa. Rav Aaron usually comes late. Baruch Hashem. Okay, I'm happy to hear it, because when I saw Rav Aaron with two students at 6:31, I said to my wife, I can't believe it. They told me the truth that he's saying Shia, but they lied to me. They told me they're going to Rav Aaron Shia. That's why my Shia was canceled. Vibrenu Shalilam. Anyway, this was Maimonides. Now, the Rav took the greatest love and pride and joy in Maimonides. Every Friday, he came into the classes, he tested the students. It was his joy, it was his achievement, it was his accomplishment. Read some of the words that I have in my book where the Rav talks about from his terrace. He heard kids talking. What are the Jewish kids? This was in Roxbury, I believe, but there was a Jewish neighborhood at the time. He heard Jewish kids from his porch, perhaps, not his terrace. I'm giving it an Israeli connotation. From the porch of his private home, he heard Jewish kids talking what they ate for breakfast. What did they have for breakfast? Bacon and eggs. And he said, it's only now, he said, in Europe, I could never appreciate what it meant to educate, to give education to kids that have such little background. But when I see in Maimonides what our children are getting and what the other Jewish children do not have, I can appreciate education. He had very interesting ideas, Maimonides, that were very unique to the Rav. For instance, there was school Chol HaMoed Sukkot. Does anyone know why there was school Chol HaMoed Sukkot? I explained it in the book. Children who didn't come from a frum home could be notel, lulav, and etrog, could eat in the sukkah. It was more important to the Rav they should come to the school in Chol HaMoed Sukkot and be able to participate in the mitzvot and see the mitzvot. This was ingenious. I understand what went on. Erev Yom Kippur, he davened, and Yitzchak can correct me, but I understand in Maimonides, he davened with Maimonides on Erev Yom Kippur, the Mincha Gedola, and set a shmuas for them. I mean, could you imagine high school kids, ruffians, rednecks? What are we talking about here? Bostonians, and the Rav is davening mincha with them Erev Yom Kippur, and before the mincha says a shmuah, says a few words. I mean, Ribbono Shel Olam, what a schud. And this was the Rav's greatest joy. Some of the stories out of my mind, that he's a fabulous, the story of the kid, of course this is a documented story, the kid who, I don't have it in my book, but it's written up in Legacy. It's not important as far as the Rav's life go, but it's important understanding the Rav as a human being. This kid was thrown out of class. Also, you know, I call your attention, throwing a kid out of class is not the best solution. All you're doing is rewarding the kid, because the kid is a troublemaker. So you throw the kid out of class, so he's free. He doesn't have, he's suspended. He's a happy kid. And you know, in YU, in our days, it was legendary. Mr. Abrams suspended you. I suspended indefinitely for 2 days. You'll bring your father or mother or one of your parents. Otherwise, you will not be allowed back into class. Suspended indefinitely for 2 days. Your father, your mother, or one of your parents. Anyway, but, you know, what did it accomplish? All it did is reward the kid for being a ruffian, so he gets a day off. Anyway, the Rav is walking through the hallway, and there's this kid. I don't know where they suspended kids in my mother's, where they sat. I know where they used to sit in MTA in my years, but I don't know my mother's, but this kid is sitting and crying. So the Rav comes over, and he asks the kid, "What are you crying?" And the kid said he was thrown out of class, and he's going to have an exam, and he's not hearing the lecture, and he's not going to be prepared for the exam, and he's worried he won't do well. So the Rav says to the kid, what are you studying? And I think the kid answered, whatever it was, Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet, whatever it was, something in Navi. And the Rav says, come, I'll study with you. And this kid says, do you really know it? And the Rav says, well, I think I do. And he studies with the kid. The kid passes the exam. And years later, this kid said, you know, when the story went out and the kid realized who the Rav was, it changed the course of his life. So this is Maimonides. This was a tremendous achievement. However, and now I must say the truth, and I allude to this between the lines. I allude to it because it's hard. It's hard to say it. The Rav is in Boston, and I don't offend, there's some Bostonians here, cogging up, we have the new generation, the old generation, I don't want to offend anyone. Adam, okay, Baruch Hashem. Matt Brenner, correct, Sharon, Massachusetts. Yeah, correct. I know I said Adam, because I had a student, Adam Brenner, in the Kollel a few years ago. Was that a relative, by the way? No, but that always... Yeah, but then, no, that happens in your mind. You get, there's a name that goes in your mind. Let's see, is there anyone else here from Boston? Who? Hazelcorn, but Hazelcorn is not sitting here now. Okay, so anyway, we have at least 3 Bostonians in the room. With all due respects to Boston, so the Rav now is in Boston, he's suffering the rabbinate, but he is achieving something in education. He's achieving Maimonides. He's doing something epic making as far as that goes. Oh, and let me add something else too before I go further, before I come into the brutal truth. Let me add something else. The Rav and Maimonides did something that no one else did before in the United States. And when you look back at it now with the passage of time, it's epic making. He insisted on teaching women exactly the way he taught men. Cynics might say, because his elder children were daughters. And all of you know, don't need a finer example than Rashi. Those of you that have seen the Beryl Wine video. By the way, in the Beryl Wine video, it talks about 2 daughters of Rashi. As far as I know, Rashi had 3 daughters. So I know that, as I recall from graduate school, there was even a theory there was a 4th daughter. But 3 daughters is what I recall, and the video that Beryl Wine did on Rashi, as far as I saw the whole video. It only talks about 2 daughters, so I don't know. Maybe there's a missing link that I'm unaware of, or maybe there was new research. I have to go through Avram Grossman's major work. I have it planned, Be'ezrat Hashem, this summer. I want to go through Avram Grossman's epic-making work on Rashi and his era, and see what the scholarship has on it. 2 daughters. So what? But I'm almost positive. Anyone ever heard of 3 daughters? You're looking at me with a question mark. You heard of 3. I was raised on that Rashi had 3 daughters. Okay. It has to be checked out. The Rav You can be cynical and say, because he had daughters, he emulated Rashi. If you don't have sons, you educate your daughters. There is some truth to that. There is some truth to that, and no one knows it better than I do. However, with all that being said, the Rav evidently felt that in America, boys and girls need exactly the same education. Talmud Torah is not the determining factor here. You can say all the pilpulim in the world, and believe me, I know the material. Are women chayiv in Talmud Torah? What are they chayiv in? What is the kiyum, etc.? All the pilpulim in the world, it's like I'm paraphrasing what the Rav said about Bichat Kahanim Pekatanim. I have in my book where the Rav, and many times, and Rav Heschel writes about this too, that the Rav held it was idiocy to get involved in whether there's chinuch by Kohanim Katanim. And he said, in America, every Kohen, every kid should get up and duchen, because otherwise they will not know their Kohanim. Kahuna in America was an institution which outside of New York City, again, Borough Park, everyone knows who's a Kohen, who's a Levi. Outside of Borough Park, find out the length and breadth of America. So the Rav was very mocked, but he said, it's ludicrous to get involved here in Lundis. Halach l'maisa, every kid has to duchen. The Rav felt evidently with chinuch banot that in America, with women going to high school and women going to college and every door open to women and every challenge at their doorsteps, women are obligated simply for survival to learn Torah on a high level. And once they learn Torah, ein mala hafchin, you cannot differentiate. And the Rav was way ahead of the crowd in Maimonides from day one. Boys and girls were treated equally. Unlike Ramaz. My wife went to Ramaz. Until today, she's furious because every time it came to Gemara, the boys went to learn Gemara and the women went to home economics. And to my wife, that was a terrible put down. Boys are learning Gemara and women are relegated to the kitchen learning how to kasher chickens, which not one of them ever kashered a chicken in their life, because by the late 50s, the frozen chickens conquered the market. And today you have, there isn't a woman in this kollel married to any of you fellas who knows how to kasher, who's ever seen kashering. We're reaching the point that no one knows how to make a Pesach Seder. I never saw anything like it. Everyone goes away for Pesach, population exchange. Endless treif hotels become glat kosher, and no one knows how to kasher a kitchen. No one knows how to prepare a kitchen for Pesach. No one knows how to prepare for a Seder. Everything, all right, maybe, could be. We'll never have private sturim alone. Everything is going to be in the public thoroughfare. This is the nature of the beast. Could be. I shouldn't be complaining. None of us sew our own clothes. None of us make our own bread. None of us churn our own butter. So what the hell is Rakefet complaining about that people can't kasher chickens or don't know how to prepare a house for Pesach or don't know how to kasher out an oven, etc. Okay, and it's very true. I had in Woodmere. You know, today, Ramaz, it's a different story, but the Rav was way ahead of the pack. But I'd like to see in Ramaz, Zalzayin, a bissel frumkite. They should give a frumkite award in addition to a Gemara award. Let's be honest, Ribbono Shel Olam. The girls are Ramaz. I have girls from Ramaz every once in a while in Midrashet. They tell me stories. They won a championship, won a game. The boys went out. God have mercy. Where they ate, they were having a party. So the frum kids didn't eat anything really treif. In other words, and didn't. I don't even want to repeat the story, understand? So, Zoman Zayin Gesund. Gemara today, Gemara tomorrow. If it's not rooted in Yirat Shemayim, it helps via Taitam Bankus. Now. But now let's tell the truth. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, and this I have from family and close students of Reb Moshe, this is inside analysis, but absolutely true. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik was extremely troubled. He was suffering. Here is his son. As Shulamit said to me a week ago, my father made the Rav. Don't need Shulamit to tell me that. We all know it. Here is his son that he put so much effort into. So much learning. So much knowledge. Here is his son, the Gaonim Shel B'Gaonim. And here is his son wasting away in Boston. The rabbinate, Machloket. heartache, slaughter. Who does he have to say a shir for? Who can he say a chiddush for? Who can he solve a Rambam for? And with all due respects, and he had the Rav Hadbalim, the Rav talks about it, the Rav Hadbalim Batnim, who were Bucky and Shas and Paiskim. Rav had a handful of Balabatim that were old-time Europeansha first-rate Lamdanim. But it doesn't mean they held by learning. In America, they knew how to learn. They continued learning, but their minds were in business. They ran factories. They had stores. They were involved in business. I mean, it's still, with all due respect to our Balabas who knows Shas, he's still not a yeshiva student. They're slicked in learning. Maimonides, with all due respects to Maimonides, Reb Moshe looked on quizzically from New York City. This is what my son is doing. This is what the greatest going in the world is doing. He's sitting and learning with an 8-year-old kid a chapter from Shmuel Aleph. Yeah, Freitzich, you know in my book, it's the most moving part of my book. I mean, I dramatize it. I do it. When I do it, the book is a waste of time because it's not alive. Torah Shemichtav. But they're in there when the Rav spoke about Borei Olamot u'Machrivam, what we learn, Europe, why am I so impressed? Let him... world before Purim. Chanuch Davidman, where's Chanuch? I just saw him this morning, running away. Dov Hachbaum. Where's Dov? I see a big crowd here. Ari Cutler, Judah Dardick, Seth Kleinman, Seth Bronstein, Matt Brenner, Jonathan Kaganov, Eli Babish, Reuven Bashnak, Zvi Engel, I saw Zvi enter, Barry Goldgrab, Silvergrab today, Jacob Vito Milansky, Avram Yaakov Lawrence. Is there anyone whose name I did not call who belongs on this list? The gentleman. What I have. Avi, are you in this class or you're in the other class, Ani? Other class. That's your father. That's a closer generation to the Ktzais. We got it, gentlemen. When the Rebbe says it's worth $1 million, I'm not overstated. You got my message, Jack? Have patience, gentlemen. Then we'll get there. Believe me, Josh, you're going to say moldim that you came to class today. Believe me. Reb Moshe is going crazy. This is his son in Boston. This is what he put all this effort into. Now, while Reb Moshe is going crazy, the sociological picture of American Orthodoxy is changing radically. Unless you understand what I'm about to explain, you can never ever understand what happened to American Orthodoxy in the late 30s into the 40s. And it's very simple. Before approximately 1935, any committed Torah Jew who came to America knew he was risking his life. And therefore, if he came to America, it was a sign that there was a bit of a rebellion in him. You didn't walk away from Europe to go to America if you didn't have a rebellious streak. And I told that, there was a great Rosh Yeshiva of KBY, Rav Chaim Goldwich. Some of you may remember Rav Goldwich. I hope you do. So Rav Goldwich and I once spent an unbelievable weekend together in Lawrence. And the whole weekend, no one slept that weekend except the women. All the men, we were up all. I was younger and he was younger. It was unbelievable what went on. And I put Goldwich, I put the Karen B. Avner Rosh Yeshiva against the wall. We're good friends. I taught his daughter, so we go back many decades. So I could do it. And he was boasting, he's not a Mizrahiite, he only went to KBY because the Chazon Ish told him to go. And I said to him, Kerem Biyavna Rosh Yeshiva, Amachta Toyas, you're making a mistake. The Chazon Ish saw that little Mizrahi Tselem in your heart. That's why he sent you to KBY. Don't tell me otherwise. And he went crazy denying it, but in all his denial, he thinks he denied it too much. Believe me, that little Mizrahi, I don't want to use the word I used in Hebrew and English, but it's an old expression. The Chazon Ish already saw that he was bitten, and he was already on the bad path of Mizrahiism. So, if you came to America before 35, come on, you knew you were risking your children. You knew you were risking your Olam Haba. Great Rabbanim came, Rabbi Dov Aryeh Cohen Leventhal, the rabbi of Philadelphia, Danny Yalkut is going to do a doctorate on his life. He knew he was risking plenty. His son becomes the most prominent conservative rabbi in New York, etc. And we can go right down the line with one example after another. Yeah, to be a rebel, Reb Lezer Silva was a rebel. The truth of the matter is, and I couldn't say this in my book, Reb Lezer married out of love. He met a beautiful girl, a librarian, a young girl, fell in love, married her father. His father went crazy. His father was a big rub. He had to run to America to get away from the America. It's a free country. You do what you want. He came to America. That's Reb Lezer Silva. That's why he wound up in America. By the mid-30s, thousands of frum Jews were running away to the United States, not because they wanted to, not because they had a vision of freedom, not because they were rebels. They were running away to the United States to save their lives, pshuto kamashmau, from Hitler. And for the first time you have in America yeshiva people, Lundisha people, Hasidisha people, Litvisha Reshi Yeshiva, Hasidic Rebbeim, people who are coming to America and are not going to compromise Ki Huzeh. It's a different breed. And Reb Moshe comes up with a fabulous idea, and we have to give Rabbi Revel credit, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha. Rabbi Revel went along with it. Of course, Reb Moshe by that time had established himself as the predominant Rosh Yeshiva in YU on the American scene. Rabbi Revel, of course, bowed to him, but this was a tremendous decision. Let the Rev open a postgraduate kollel for the best yeshiva boys coming in from Europe or graduates of yeshiva and yeshiva college, Musmachim of the Yeshiva in Boston. And in 1939, the Rav opens what's known as popularly as the Boston Kollel. It had a technical name, Heichal Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi, the Yeshivat Torat Yisrael. Yeshivat Torat Yisrael. Torat Yisrael was an old Boston institution that had evolved over the years, and it provided for kids that went to high school. They were able to study Gemara. That's a different story. But the Rav wanted it in memory of Reb Chaim, so it had a long formal name, and it functioned officially as a branch of Yeshiva, what is today Yeshiva University. It was like a postgraduate college. It's an overwhelming idea. Tremendous minds gathered around the Rav. Americans who had studied in Europe and ran back from the European yeshivas because of Hitler gathered around the Rav. A lot of Chafetz Chaim fellows gathered around the Rav. You have the Scheinberg family, the Chait family, one after another, the Bakshd family, one after another, people gathered around the Rav, the Back family, Rav Binyamin Back of Baltimore, one after another, the finest minds. It was an unbelievable kollel. And Reb Moshe now had the dream that in response to such students, the Rav would find himself, would be a tremendous machadesh, and the Rav's life would be enriched, and the Rav would have self-fulfillment. Reb Moshe was overjoyed. Some of the descriptions of the kollel, which lasted about two and a half years. I'll explain what happened in a second. It should be obvious. The descriptions I've heard from students who studied there, it was just like brisk. The Rav, if you recall, 2 weeks ago I spoke about the letter of Reb Meir Berlin offering the job in YU, and Rav Moshe was upset that the Rav would have to say shir every day on a high school level. He should only say shir when he has chidushim to give to the best students in the yeshiva. That's exactly what happened. The stories are legendary. The Rav once woke the students up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And he said it was a difficult Rambam. They sweated. It was just like Briz. They were learning. They were sweating. Suddenly, in the middle of the night, the Rav worked it out. He couldn't wait. Woke them up. Zag bircha satayra. The Gaon sheet. I have that in my book too, the story with the Gaon. Zag bircha satayra. And he got them together and worked out the Rambam. And by 7 o'clock in the morning, when it was time to daven shacharis, the Rambam was worked out. The Rav was overjoyed. I've often thought, what would have become of that Boston branch if Rav Moshe and Rabbi Revel didn't pass on? Another 5-6 years, the Rav would have raised Lamdanim of Hakim. He beat Lakewood to the jump. He beat Spring Valley, Beis Medrash Elyon of Teira Vedas to the jump. But it didn't last. When Rav Moshe died, when the Rav finally succeeded him, the Rav could no longer be in two places at once. And since he was spending the heart of the week in New York, the Boston Kollel suffered. Now, the Rav did not close it down. Does anyone know what happened? I write about it. The Rav was very close to his cousin, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Feinstein. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Feinstein was a son of Rav Moshe's brother. In other words, he was a nephew to Rav Moshe, and he was something like a second cousin to the Rav. So the Rav was Makarifim, and he was in America at that time. And he continued to run the Kollel much later. He continued to run the Kollel. He was a bachelor. Then Rav Moshe needed help in New York. MTJ was expanding, World War II. So Rabbi Yechiel Michal went to New York, and he was with Rav Moshe. Later in life, and this all has to be checked out, dates it probably can be reestablished. I state this for the year 2050 from Hapradesh. Later in life, they talked in terms of a shidduch with the Brisker Rav's daughter. The Brisker Rav, of course, a relation. Rabbi Yechiel Michal, the great Talmud Chacham. So he had to go back to Eretz Yisrael to marry the Brisker Rav's daughter. Then he came to America again. The Brisker Rav was furious, and I write about this in the book, with a Rav and his beautiful chesed for his uncle, who is a great Zionist, the great American Zionist leaders who ripped Kriya when their children say they want to go in Aliyah, or the Brisker Rav, who refused to correspond with his daughter and son-in-law, Kolzman, they went Chutz Laretz. And on the return, again, he went back to Boston. Something was organized again, but it never really caught on a major level. And Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein was under pressure from the Brisker Rav, obviously. At a certain point, he returns to Eretz Yisrael, opens up a Kollel Shevet Yehuda, which for many decades was in Tel Aviv, and now, like all the other Tel Aviv Torah institutions, has moved on to Bnei Brak. So that's the story with Maimonides, with the Kollel, with this great achievement of putting a day school on the map, and with the attempt Rav Moshe gets Rabbi Revel involved. And I have all the details, both in Revel, a little bit in the Rav. I have all the details how it would work as a branch and what the hours were. Now, one of the people who studied with the Rav in the Kollel in Boston, Rabbi Gotthold, was very upset, both with what I wrote in Revel and both with what I wrote in the Rav, because I described the arrangement, how many times the Rav would have to say Shia. He said to me, "What are you, crazy? That was what was required by contract. But the Rav said, shiur whenever he wanted to, at every free moment. I said, I understand that, but I still am reproducing a document of the agreement between the Rav and Rabbi Revel. But nevertheless, I make clear to you, it was bris. There was no clock. It was at every moment. Of course, he was more limited during the day where he had communal responsibilities. But every spare moment, night, 4 o'clock, 4 a.m., 5 a.m., and Scheinberg's families and Chait's families, there's a lot of Chafetz Chaim people, they all gathered around the Rav. There was a tremendous nucleus. The Shurin brothers, that's another family. These were all Europeisha. Later, one of the Shurin brothers marries Rabban, marries into Rabban Soloveitchik's family. Rabban Soloveitchik marries Ella Shurin, who is a sister to the Shurins that studied with the Rav in the Kollel in Boston. So you have the Back family, a number of very interesting, fascinating families that go on to play a role on the Torah world scene, who all studied with the Rav in Boston. Now, there's one part I skipped over chronologically. And if you follow the volume, I have here, we're now on page 36. We have to go back. And in producing the volume, I had the terrible problem of, do you handle it chronologically, or do you handle it topically? And I made the decision to handle it topically because I didn't feel I could interrupt the story of Maimonides and the story of the Heichel Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi with the Tel Aviv issue. Now let me say a few words about Tel Aviv, and let me come back to Menachem Ginek. Obviously in 1935, the Rav had arrived in Boston. He was no longer a total greenhorn. He was far from a success. The Rabbinate Eretz Ochelet Yoshvecha, the Rabbinate in America, was a bedrock of aggravation for the Europeish Rabbanim. By now the Rav knew America to a certain degree, knew Boston to a certain degree, and the Rav understood a man of his ability, capability, learning, knowledge, background, family, pedigree is not going to be fulfilled in Boston. The Tel Aviv Rabbinate opened. Rav Shlomo Zalman Aronson, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi, passed on. Tel Aviv was the largest Jewish city in the world. It still remains the largest city in the world, which is almost entirely, totally Jewish, although Tel Aviv is second today in Yerushalayim as far as population, and Yerushalayim, I believe, even has more Jews than Tel Aviv at this moment in time. It was a very prestigious and important rabbinate. It boggles the mind to think what would have happened to the Rav, what would have become of the Rav, what would have become an Eretz Yisrael, where would we be today? One thing is for sure, we would not be sitting here talking about the Rav. It would have been an entire different ballpark. The man was young. He had many decades in which to develop himself, in which to interact. It would have been an entirely different Rav. Although I have confidence, it would have been spectacular. The Rav decided to stand for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv. First of all, his great-great-uncle, Rav Meir Berlin, was very active on the Mizrahi scene. Rav Meir Berlin was the world president of Mizrahi, and the Rav felt that he would have an ally in Rav Meir Berlin. Secondly, we now come to Menachem Ginek. Menachem Ginek's real name, his father changed it, is Genachovsky. The minute you hear the name Genachovsky, it tells you that Menachem Ginek's uncle, his father's older brother, Rabbi Elia Moshe, I believe was the name, I have it in the book, was the Rav's playmate from Warsaw, who a Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik in Tachamoni, who went with the Rav to Berlin. This uncle was very close to the Rav, bosom buddy. They met their wives together. He remains in Eretz Yisrael. plays a very important role in the Religious Council of Tel Aviv. He later goes on to become a well-to-do businessman, a great Mizrahi politician, a member of the Knesset of the State of Israel. I don't say that with great dignity or honor, but maybe in those days it was more honorable than today. The Rav took for granted that he would have the support of his old friend Genachovsky, and he decided to stand for the chief rabbin of Tel Aviv. Now, coming back to Menachem Genach, this will explain to you the unique relationship that Menachem Genach enjoyed with the Rav. Menachem, in his own right, is a fine Talmud Chacham, a Yirei Shemayim, but it's much more than that. When he fed into the Rav's shir in the late 60s, and I'm recording this for the year 2050, it's not something that you can talk about now. The Rav's son was already in Eretz Yisrael. Remember, Chaim went to Eretz Yisrael before the outbreak of the Six-Day War, was here for the Six-Day War, and for many years afterwards did not leave, did his doctorate here, was teaching here. Everyone thought he would marry here and remain here. Chaim's being here left a void in the Rav's life. I would say to a certain degree, Menachem became a son figure or a son prototype or a son substitute for the Rav. At that point in life, Menachem Genach, the nephew of, it was family for the Rav. And Genachem enjoys a very wonderful relationship with the Rav throughout the ensuing decades, even when we talk about the missing tapes, when the Rav gave them over to Julie Berman, Menachem Genach was there to witness it as part of the family, as part of those closest to the Rav. So that will explain to you Menachem Genach's relationship with the Rav and how he could get away with telling the Rav off, stopping the Rav from teaching Likutei Torah, and be a counter ego to the Rav to a certain degree. This is Menachem Genach. And Kol HaKavod to Menachem, he publishes a lot of the Rav's Torah, and you can be certain what he publishes is Kavanaki. He's reliable, and he recognizes his relationship, his responsibility. Now, the Rav makes the big trip to Tel Aviv. When we speak in terms of a big trip, nowadays everyone in the class is laughing at me. You daven Mincha Maariv in Woodmere, get on the plane at JFK, and you daven Shacharis at the Kotel the next morning quite early. This is nowadays. In those days, to go to Eretz Yisrael was a long trip by boat. The Rav makes the trip by boat. Here, too, the stories are anecdotal and legendary. The Rav was told in Eretz Yisrael they do not recognize a rabbi without a beard. He grew a full beard in anticipation of the election for the rabbinate. On the boat, the Rav practiced Matan Hebrew. They tell stories. He stood in front of a mirror and spoke in Ivrit Meduberet. And with his Gonish mind, particularly his facility with languages, which is just amazing, he mastered Matan Hebrew. And I heard the Rav speak Matan Hebrew many years later when Rav Nissen came to the yeshiva, and it was just shocking how good his Hebrew was. I mean, all the Rosh Yeshiva, including Rav David Lifshitz, Rav David spoke Hebrew well, but it was an Ashkenazic Hebrew. You could hear his Ashkenazic accent was overwhelming. The Rav spoke Matan Hebrew practically like an Israeli. It was amazing. And the Rav comes to Eretz Yisrael. He leaves a tremendous impression. I have the description in my volume. He speaks at Merkaz HaRav. He speaks at Chevron. He gives lectures to the so-called secular element of the population, but it was at that time a Jewish secular element. It's not like today that Rakepet has given lectures on the three types of Israelis, namely Jewish Israelis, Israelis of Jewish origins, and the Erev Rav. Then even the Israelis of Jewish origins were Jewish Israelis, and that's a tremendous difference. You have to understand it. The people were overwhelmed, were inspired. They couldn't believe what they heard. I want to make one correction. On the two tapes I recorded about the Rav for the OU, on one tape, there is one mistake, which is a real mistake. There is no other mistake on these two tapes. people have listened and re-listened. I've been challenged and re-challenged. And as you know, I've even proven that the Rav was more than 6 foot tall in the 30s into the 40s into the 50s. However, there is one mistake. I state about the Rav speaking at Bialik's Onik Shabbat in Tel Aviv. All of you know what I'm talking about. Chaim Nachum Bialik, the old Voloshiner yeshiva boy, becomes the poet laureate of the Jewish people, becomes what we would call a traditional Jew, and he has Onik Shabbat Friday night in Tel Aviv, which was an institution. I don't believe it exists today, but it was an institution, and many Jews who are not that pious would come, because a Jew can be an apikoros, but he still has a Leil Shabbat. I say on the tape that when the Rav spoke in Matan Hebrew on a philosophic topic, Bialik cried from Hitrakshut that the great-grandson of his Rebbe the Netziv could be so knowledgeable. So knowledgeable in world philosophy, Matan Hebrew, so with it, and be a gon adir and a tzaddik. What I said is incorrect. It has to be incorrect. I was misinformed. Bialik died in 34. This took place in 35. And evidently, the people who described this to me, and I remembered vividly people describing this to me in the late 60s, early 70s, what they probably were confusing was that the Rav spoke at Bialik's Onik Shabbat, but Bialik was no longer alive. But the people who were there were overwhelmed. Among them were many learned, erudite people, people like Bialik, or in Bialik's Chug, as we say, who were overwhelmed that the Netziv's great-grandson could be so knowledgeable. So the story is, I believe, to be totally correct, but Bialik was not there. And that evidently was a juxtaposition of Bialik and Bialik's Onik Shabbat. The Rav was not elected. And here, it took me a long time to understand why not. People generally attribute the Rav's not being elected to the fact that he was identified with Agudat Yisrael. I'm not going to be able to go much further. I want to deal with this now in a little bit depth and allow time for another matter. I do not believe this to be correct. I'll tell you why this comes about, and let me put it all into context. I've spoken about this many times in the Kol. It's an unbelievable story. For whatever the reasons are, little Ani Rothkopf always had a tremendous interest in Torah history, Gedolei Yisrael. I've often tried to analyze it psychologically because I look at all my other classmates, I could learn as well as most of them, and yet I had an added advantage that none of them developed. And I don't know. I think I can only answer because I don't come from a rabbinic home, so I try to make up for what I was lacking by my interest. I can still remember when I bought Mosta Tatora Beirepo, which was the greatest purchase I ever made for $10, which was a lot of money. Rav Volk couldn't believe I wasted $10 on most of the Torah. He looked at it and laughed, and to me, it's one of the most basic tools of research that I own. So when the Igrot Chazon Ish appeared, I bought it. And I want to tell you, when I say I bought, you understand, you listen to a poor kid. I was a poor kid. When I say I bought, this was I didn't have money. I mean, my parents didn't have money. I didn't own two suits. I had one suit for all year. Never knew what a summer weight suit was. Too later. So don't misunderstand me. I say I bought a book. I bought, I suffered. I scavenged to put the money together. So I buy the Igrot Chazon Ish, and knowing a little bit Jewish history, I was much younger than you at the time, but I already knew a little bit. I see this letter from the Chazon, from Reb Chaim Moisek Wyszynski to the Chazon Ish. The letter reads, and it's been reprinted in Igrot Achiyasa, that's Reb Chaim Moisek's Igrot, it's been reprinted many times. And the letter reads, it's 1935, the Chazon Ish already is coming Aliyah, he came from Vilna, Reb Chaim Moisek Wyszynski knew him, and Reb Chaim Moisek Wyszynski is writing to him, you have an election for the chief rabbinate, support this individual, his name is Harav, and it -, the name is not there in the letter, they censored the name. He is a great Talmud Chacham, he's a Yerei Shemayim, but I'm afraid he will not be elected because he is not a Mizrahi Bolet. He's not an outstanding Mizrahiite, which is a code word for saying people think he's on a good dish. Please support him with all your heart and soul. I will appreciate it. Chaim Weiser Grzynski. I open it up, I read it, and little Ani Rothkopf in his mind says, you know, this has to be the Rav. Who's he talking about? Who stood for the rabbin at 1935? Now, if I made that assumption, a few hundred other knowledgeable people in that area made that assumption. Except, I showed it to the Rav. It was after class. I opened it up. I said, Rebbe, take a look. By the way, you should know that after class we spoke English to the Rav. It was interesting. We spoke English. He would respond in English or Yiddish. In class we spoke Yiddish. But after God said, Rebbe, look at this letter. Heshi Schechter was standing around, Abba Brunspiegel was standing around, Jerry Blau was standing around. They were all witnesses to this. And the Rav looks at it, and he says, and I'll never forget it, he's sitting there, it's after class, a little bit relaxed, leaning back, and we're around his big desk. The desk was like this, a big desk. Maybe this size. I was sitting here. You see it in the book, that picture's right there. And Rebbe looks and says, yes, fill in my name. You see those blanks? And he's smiling. He says, you see those blanks? There's Yosef, Dov, Halevi, Soloveitchik. And we walked out, and that was history. Many years later, the Rav dies. Aaron, little Ani Rothkopf has now become Aaron Rekefet. He's in New York and the illustrious congregation, Lincoln's Square Synagogue, hears that I'm in New York. It was during the summer, and they call me. The executive director then was my student, Schwartz. He says, Rebbe, we'd like you to give 6 lectures. You're going to be here how many more weeks? I'm going to be another 3 weeks. Give 2 lectures a week on the Rav. Fine. I give these 6 lectures. Kid comes over to me, I don't even know what a computer is, so he says, Rebbe, would you mind if I put this into the internet? I say, do whatever you want, but make clear it's your rendition of what I'm saying. Because I don't want to, you know, if you say you think I said this, it's fine. I just don't want to sign it because I'm not editing it. I don't have time to edit it, but do what you want. It's an open world. If I say something, anyone can quote it. I get back to Israel, I get a call from a guy, Rabbi Shlomo Pick, who I've never met in my life, teaches at Bar Ilan in the Kollel. He's a Talmud of the Rav, Rabbi Lichtenstein, out of the late 60s, 70s. He calls me, he says, I read what you said about the Rav, your lectures at Lincoln Square, and you made a terrible mistake. What mistake? He says, that letter from Chaim Weiser was not to support the Rav. So what are you talking about? The Rav told me. The Rav told you? The Rav made a mistake. My dear friends, the Rav made a mistake in his own biography. Twice the Rav made a mistake. Once was with 4 to 6, I spoke about it with the Avodat Melech. And what do you mean the Rav made a mistake? I'm friendly with the Chazon Ish's family. They have the original letter. They showed it to me. It's Rav Shlomo Yosef Kahneman, the man who later becomes Panovich Rosh Yeshiva. That's who Rav Chaim Weiser was writing for, not the Rav. I said, are you sure? Get me a Xerox. Calls me back. The family refuses to make it. You know, good Haredi mentality. Like they're going, maybe they figured I'd publish it. I'd rob them of it. I don't know. Funny shalom. I called Rabbi Lichtenstein. I said, Aaron, tell me. I don't know the Shlomo Pick. He says he's your student. He's told me the following. Is he reliable? Aaron says, yes. He is absolutely trustworthy. Heshi's preparing Nefesh HaRav. She sends me a copy of some biographical material, and there he has the story, just what happened in class, that the Rav said, fill my name in. I called him, I said, you can't write it, the Rav was wrong. Couldn't believe, I said, I'm telling you, the Rav was wrong. Pick told him the story. If you look in to Nefesh HaRav, you'll see a long footnote that we thought it was, but I was told it's different, etc. Now, the reason the Rav lost the rabbin in Tel Aviv was not because they are good leanings. That played a very minor role. My dear students, timing in life is crucial. In 1935, the Rav was not the Rav. He was a kid. He was early 30s. His father writes a letter to the chairman of the Moetzel Datir of Tel Aviv. It's the funniest letter in the world. I cite it in the book where his father writes, "My son is between the ages of 30 to 40. Reb Moshe didn't know that his son was 32 years of age. Reuven Bashnak doesn't know how old his son is. When he's through with the shir, his son is going to know how old he is. That's how bright he's going to be from the shir. You don't know how old you are? What's going on here? What kind of idiocy is this? But Reb Moshe was trying to fudge the fact that the Rav was all of 32. And at the age of 32, no one is going to elect you to the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv. And Reb Meir Berlin, the Rav's own uncle, ultimately opposed him. And even worse, his bosom buddy, Genachovsky, voted against him. And the Rav was angry. Menachem told me the Rav never forgave his buddy. But Reb Meir Berlin said it best. Reb Meir Berlin said there were three main candidates for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv, 1935. I have it in a footnote. The Meir Dikvot. Rav Herzog was the greatest tzaddik. The Rav was the greatest lamdan. But Rav Amiel of Antwerp, Belgium, was the most matim, the most pasik, the one who was most fitting at that time for the city of Tel Aviv. He was a well-known rabbi. He was in the height of prime of age and power, prestige, reputation. It was early 50s. He was a Mizrahi leader. He had experience of life. He knew how to deal with Balabatim. He brought with him 30 years in the rabbinate. The Rav was looked upon as a youngster. So that it's no disgrace that the Rav wasn't elected. We can understand why Rav Amiel was elected. And Rav Amiel went on to become the great chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, second to none. Ein Achinami, a first grade outstanding success story. The Rav went back to Boston. The Hashkacha willed otherwise. And the rest is magnificent history. So this was Tel Aviv. Hold on 1 second. Now let me tell you about Shlomo Pick, about who we're talking about. 1 second. I just want to be sure we pick up the heart of the shir and the tape, then I'll open it, but I have a lot more. My dear friends, Shabbos morning in shul, give Seth a smack there. Darn it. Get him to claim him. You're not allowed to. Seth, my boy, will testify. We davened at the same minyan Shabbos morning, 6:30. But what Seth can't testify, because we davened in a shul with room for 800 people, and there are about 30 at that first minyan, each person has 5 benches to himself. What Seth cannot testify is that a lot of people came over to me and said, "You mentioned B'duchilu and Rechimu in Hatzofa of Shabbos, something with Chareda Zatzia." And no one could tell me exactly what's going on. They just said, "Oh, they mentioned ba 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 ba." After Shabbos, I lifted a copy of Hatzofa off one of my neighbors, and I couldn't believe my eyes. Chareda, it's a tremendous article. I had to get the secretary Midreshet to play with this in order to get this on one page. I had to give the secretary a gift afterwards. Chareda Zatzia Ledivrei Hagon Reb Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. And who is the author? Our friend Shlomo Pick. And I couldn't believe my eyes. He takes Michal Shurkin, Rabbi Shurkin, and Chaim Soloveitchik, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, and he rubs them through the mud, and he puts Asham Plutter on them, and he says, "We have only one honest man, Rakefet," and he cites it properly. You're supposed to, when you cite my book in Hebrew, you have to write it in English. I couldn't believe my eyes. Why? I couldn't believe what this guy did. He is the most pedantic scholar in the world. He says, this is his theme. Everyone in the world is trying to turn the Rav into a Haredi today. He says, you open up Michal Shurkin's work, Harare Kedem? And how does he spell the Rav's name? Samach Aleph Lamed Aleph Vav Vav, the old fashioned Europeish way. This is to try to turn him into a Haredi, that he's like Reb Chaim, he hasn't left Europe. And then he goes after Professor, he takes Chaim, and his, by name, and his son, and Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, who did a doctorate, and he tells what his doctorate, and when he published, I couldn't believe my eyes. And he told a rotten, vicious, malicious, tenet, rate of satsia, takes one of the books that Chaim put out on the Rav a few years ago, Soloveitchik, spelled like in Europe, but Harav, and you read it with such the Harav, Arin Rakefet Ratkaf, Mechabe HaSefer, and the Rav, he goes on, he says, not only did Rothkopf reproduce letter from the Rav, we don't have to quote what Rakefet writes, Soloveitchik, but he xeroxed the original letter. No, he's complimenting my scholarly technique, that the original letter is there, and he gives you the exact page, if Netochen B'Yamed X1, and it says, Soloveitchik, Samich Vav, Lamed Vav, Vet Yud, Sadi Yud Kuf. So I have to say, in a million years, I wouldn't have thought of making a case against you. Then he goes on again, Shurkin, what he does to Shurkin makes, what Chaim and Sokolov did to me makes me look like the Tzaddik and Gon Hadar compared to what he does to Shurkin here. He read every syllable in the book, and every quote isn't there, and where he got it, and where he misinterpreted, and where he didn't finish it, and he takes the Shurkin, and the, you know what the joker is? They tell me that Shlomo Pick is so Haredi, he lives in B'nai Brak, he's chaver with the Chazon Ish's family. To look at him, you wouldn't believe he ever studied in NYU. What he does in this article, I was, excuse me? Rav Yehuda Panis, YU, Haredizatzi of YU, Haredizatzi of Litivrei Hagon. I give you the copy. You can make as many copies as you want for the boys. This gives you an idea. This gives you an idea how big the original type is and what I had to cut down. Sri, yes. Oh, guilty? No, the way he spells his name. You gotta read the article, and he proves like a lot. We'll get that. Tzvi, Ribbono Shel Olam, the Rebbe's recording for the year to 2050, and you have no. We should live by the time we reach 2050. I'll be finished with these lectures. What are you worried about, my dear friends? Let me reiterate. Oh boy, Yitz, you are the Sitra Acher. I'm not going to get there. I'm not going to deal with that. Relax, we'll get there. Gentlemen, I would meet net. Okay, first, let's reiterate. You guys, the Rebbe, what God, I tell you, I'm overwhelmed. I can't believe what the Hashgacha has wrought. 1 second. Let's reiterate. What did we do today? Today, we dealt mainly with the Rev in Boston. We finished out Rav Savitsky. We dealt with Maimonides, we dealt with the Heichal, we dealt with Rav Moshe's frustrations. The unbelievable achievement, the first Kollel, what would have been in America, but the Hashgacha ruled otherwise. We went back to 35, we had to deal with Eretz Yisrael. I didn't want to deal with it chronologically because it would have upset the order of the development of Boston, but at this point we dealt with it chronologically. And the Rav has to come back to Boston. He's lost the election. He's now doomed to remain in Boston, let's put it that way, in strong language, at least for another few years, where it's not by choice, but by coercion. And then, of course, the whole world changes with the death of Reb Moshe and Dr. Raphael. Now, I have to be honest with you. I will never in my life give any two shiurim that are more important than next Sunday and Monday. I wouldn't miss it. There's no sense even charging. It's priceless. Sunday. No. Sunday with Afkat Kedushin. You saw Jerry Blau dancing like a little kid when I gave him the document. That document is going to be available to everyone who comes to Shia. It is a document. Monday, I deal with YU for the year 2050. It's not for now, not to be repeated. Al Tagidu Begat. Tuesday, I leave for the United States. Pray that I should be Matzliach. A lot is at stake. Now, let me go further. This is the copy of the beautiful Chumash that's put out by Feldheim. It's an amazing volume, an amazing translation. It incorporates Rashi into the translation. In back, you have the whole davening for Shabbos. It's very usable. You don't have to look down. It's all there in front of your eyes. It's worth looking at it. Future Rabbanim, rabbis of congregations, etc. My dear friends, Marabu Masecha, 1947 World Series. I spoke about April 26, 1999, which comes out to be the most famous day of my life until now. It's the day I gave the hesped for Joe DiMaggio. I've never given a hesped, never given a shiur. Of course, it was the longest shiur I ever gave in my life. As you recall, I said there's no clock that day. It was almost a 3-hour shiur, two tapes. No clock. I list like baseball. I said, come to class if you have time. If you don't have time, don't come, because there's no end today. Thank God the room was filled. But the shiur, I never gave a shiur that has reverberated and so many people listen to it. And it's the only shiur I can tell you I've ever made money off. A balabas, my word of honor, I almost fainted, gave me a $1,000 personal check, like Weitzman, except it wasn't 2 mil, it was only a thou. He said, I want you to know, this is for you, not your wife. You wouldn't let Malka near you. We know each other. And he said, the hana, the enjoyment I had out of that shiur, this is just a token. Guy ran out of one, I almost fainted. I paid to the Lord of Aaron Rakefit $1,000 for giving a hesped for Joe DiMaggio. Now, if you remember the hesped, at least I got it honestly. Some of you, I'm not so sure how you make your livings. If you remember the hesped, one of the most dramatic moments in the hesped was Ein l'chadam shein lo sha'ah. The census in Vamidba before Matan Torah, every Jew counts. And I spoke about, you know, none of us are going to be like DiMaggio. DiMaggio is a giant, unique ability. He's like Rabbi Lichtenstein. None of us. With all due respect, I'm not going to put anyone down. There's no one in this room who can ever emulate Aaron. Aaron, as a kid, I know him from 1951 on. We used to call him the Babe. The Babe! As a kid already knew every word in Shas by heart. The Rav would sit here, Aaron, Avu Shteit, and Aaron was sitting there in back against the window. Psachim Samach Alev Amid Bet, Menachet Kuf Yitzayin Amar Alev. He was like a machine, like a computer. And he was never wrong.